Welcome to Creating a Family, talk about infertility. You know, so often when we think about infertility, we think that it only, or we act like it only affects the woman, the wife. But the truth is that men are affected as well. We simply just don't focus on them or how it affects them from an emotional standpoint. And this is true, of course, when it is male factor infertility, but it's also true when the male is the fertile one and the wife is the infertile one. Today, we're going to be talking with Michael Barr. He is the author of a book called Swimming in Circles, A Baby Chase Odyssey. He's also a blogger, a sports columnist, and a dad. And his book is about infertility, male infertility, and how the wife's infertility affects the husband. It is such an important topic, and he is a great interview. Let me just stop for a moment and say this is a perfect intro to a app that exists. It's been out about a year. It's called Fertistrong, and it's Ferring Pharmaceutical, who underwrites this show, is the one that's wanting us to tell you about it. It was designed by Dr. Ali Domar and Dr. Liz Grill. And if you're a longtime listener to this show, you will have heard both of them on this show. And Ali has been on the show a number of times. And they created this because of the very purpose that we're talking about, is that the impact of infertility on the men is so often overlooked. And this app is an attempt to directly address that. It's Fertistrong. And of course, it's for either your Android or your Apple phone. It is free, and you can download it at whatever the app store is. You could also get more information about it at Fertistrong.com. And it's not only for male factor. It is also for men who love an infertile woman, for them to understand how to be a better support for their wife going through these struggles. So make sure you check it out, the Fertistrong app. Let me just also note that you're going to hear a difference in sound quality. We've been making some significant changes here at Creating a Family, and are really proud of the improved sound quality. But this show is a re-airing of a show we did a couple of years ago, and as a result, it is using the old sound system. So hang with us, and the information is still terrific. Enjoy.
Today's show is going to be on male infertility, on infertility from the male perspective. And there is a distinction, and we're going to talk about both. So often we think of infertility as only affecting the women, but that is so not true. So join our guest today, Michael Barr. He is the author of Swimming in Circles, A Baby Chase Odyssey. He is also a blogger, a sports columnist, and now a dad. Welcome, Michael, to Creating a Family.
Hi, Dawn. Thanks for having me.
Well, Michael, give us the crib note version, the short version of your fertility struggles, or your story, I should say.
Yeah. Well, the story is basically my wife and I are very circuitous route to parenthood. We found out.
You have good company in this audience.
Yeah. We found out that we basically had what the doc said was 1 in a million odds of being able to create a biological child on our own. And so we went the IVF route, did that for several years, and had very little success in that regard.
How many cycles did you guys do?
We did four.
Four fresh cycles, or some of those were frozen?
We did two frozen cycles. Mm-hmm. We just jumped straight in. We didn't do IUIs. We just went straight IVF, and the last two were ICSI. Every time they told us that things looked really fantastic, and every time it went absolutely nowhere. Something that we'd actually always wanted to do since we were very young was do international adoption. So we also pursued that process, filled out all the paperwork, got our login date and all that business. And then in the end, it's kind of difficult to describe, but we were surprised and wound up with some kids without any intervention at all, save for perhaps a bottle of wine.
Everybody's dream that we can light a candle and open a bottle and end up pregnant.
Well, I do say that rather sheepishly. I feel almost guilty that was our outcome, because it was really unexpected, and I always felt this kind of kinship with folks that were going through the same thing that we were going through.
Yeah.
And so I do. I say it hesitantly because I know that we're rather fortunate.
You know, you are, and it's one of those funny things because, you know, and as well, you should celebrate your good fortune. And yet I know exactly what you mean, because others have said it as well, that when all of a sudden you get pregnant, it's almost, especially if it happens without treatment, and that does happen, it puts you in an awkward position, because so much of your support group has been people who are going through it. And then to end up pregnant without having treatment, it almost separates you in a weird way from the people who have been kind of your peeps during the whole process.
Right.
Yeah. Here is a question we got from Randy. I love the show topic. My wife thinks I don't take our infertility as seriously as she does. She kind of obsesses over it, and I kind of don't want to think so much about it. I wonder if this is the typical way the sexes deal with it, or is it just me, like my wife thinks? And he even included a smiley face emoticon. So let's talk about that. Do you think that there is something to say that, especially at the beginning, that, because it does seem to me that more often the women are the pushers and seeking treatment. I mean, is that something that you have seen as well, Michael?
Well, in terms of seeking treatment, or in terms of being able to talk about the issue?
Well, let's talk about separate the two.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not an expert on the topic. I know our story, and I know a few other stories, but certainly I know that in our case, it certainly was the case that my wife said, we're going straight for this. Of course, her situation was such that it was going to be rather painful for her to try to make babies the old-fashioned way because of her endometriosis. And so she didn't really want to deal with that. And when it turned out that I had issues too, you know, and the doc said, you know, one in a million chances, she just thought, we're just going to go straight for this. But I do think that, yeah, I mean, in my experience, it's the female that seeks out the information, will spend all the hours online looking at options, looking at other people's stories, you know, reviewing the blogs and all the other information that's available out there. And in my experience, it's usually the guys that kind of sit back and just wait to be told what to do.
You know, that actually is my, I was interested to get the question from Randy because it has been my experience as well. And again, I've not seen any research on this, but, and across the board, I have found, often with adoption as well, it is the women. And I think that may just be because it's the women who have that role, and perhaps, I don't know if it's societal or cultural or what. But I do think that, but let's say after the initial, okay, let's get into treatment. I think Randy, I'm reading between the lines, but I believe they're probably past the, getting into treatment stage. It looks like they are probably in treatment or in the midst of it. Do you think that there are some, can you make broad generalizations about how men and women might differ as to, how they handle, infertility?
Well, I can certainly take a stab, and I know that it seems to me that the woman can very easily pick up the phone, call her best friend, talk about the situation that they're in, and they're really good at talking to complete strangers about the situation that they're in too. And for the guys, you know, we don't talk about stuff like this. We don't talk about emotional issues very often. Probably the most emotional guys get when they get together, you know, and chat is you know, complications at work. But you know, it's not natural to sit down and have a beer with your buddy and say, you know, say, Joe, have I told you about my low motility? It's just not, it's not kind of part of what we do. And that's why I think it's really difficult for guys in this situation, because it's kind of taboo for us to talk about it with each other. I mean, and I'm not trying to come off as we're all, you know, macho and we don't have emotions, because we do, but I think a lot of guys bottle them up. And that's part of why I wrote this book, was because when I was going through it, I was going a little bit crazy because I didn't have anybody to talk to. And I went online and I went to the bookstore, and there really wasn't anything out there at the time kind of written for the guy or by the guy to talk about this. And so I tried to write the book that I needed at the time in my life.
Well, here we actually have a question that that goes to this the matter of what you just talked about. He writes, "I want to keep it private. My wife," and I think it, he's referring to as his infertility. "My wife wants to tell complete strangers. How did your guest? No, who? I'm sorry. Who did your guest tell?"
Gosh,
this is part of a much longer, and I'm abbreviating it quite a bit. So that's part of the. It seems a little cryptic, but. It's way too long, and some of it he wants to keep private in the email. So the anyway, the gist of the question is, I think, how do you handle that disparity of the, as you say, your wife had no problem telling complete strangers, according to this gentleman. I think his wife also, and I think that it is not atypical for women, not all women by any means, but I do think that women sometimes seek comfort, and it's they would feel comfortable with that. So who do men talk to? They've got your book, Swimming in Circles, to read. But outside of that, who did you talk to?
Yeah, it's I actually talk about that just a little bit in the book, that I found it really interesting. The people that we did choose to tell were not the folks. If I had to you know, look forward from years before we went through this, I would say, oh, it's going to be our best friends, these people and these people and these people. And we didn't tell those people at all, and I don't really understand why. We told folks that were of similar age that were childless, and really it was just, if I recall correctly, two couples. I didn't even tell my parents. We didn't even get into this, but my wife's mother worked at the infertility clinic that we went to, so she clearly knew. Pretty much everybody in my wife's social circle knew what was going on, but folks in my social circle, there were just two couples that really knew. I didn't have any close friends that I told.
Why did you not tell your parents?
I can't explain that. I really can't. My folks were older. They were in their late 60s. My dad has Parkinson's disease, and he just – my dad – my dad's not an emotional guy at all. He's very logical. He wouldn't have reacted at all, I think, if we told him. My
and
mom,
that would probably hurt your feelings, quite frankly.
Yeah, you're right about that. My mom, God bless her, she probably would have blamed my wife just because she loved me so much.
No.
And it wasn't a natural thing to talk about with them.
You know, it's when I talk to people who don't discuss it with their parents or their friends, you can usually tie it back to, I don't trust their reaction. I don't think that they will react in a way that will be helpful for me. And so that's basically what you're saying, that their response, and the truth is, particularly with our parents, we think we know how they will respond.
Right.
Out of curiosity, do your parents know now?
yes. Yeah. They know. My dad had read the book, so he knows. But when we told them that we were going to go through with international adoption, we explained what went on, and it went about as good as I thought it would. And yeah, so they knew the history, and then they were totally blew their minds when we told them that we actually were expecting. My mom had absolutely no idea how to react, but that's kind of a different story.
Interesting. So in fact, you out of curiosity, one of the things that when we talk about this, I always think it's not that it's your responsibility to have to think about this, but in truth, and I raise this because I think it with when people don't tell their parents about their fertility struggles, or don't tell their parents about the impending adoption until right before, even though I think there are sometimes good reasons for both of those, I completely get why you do it. But one of the downsides and one of the things you have to sometimes try to work around is that it can hurt their feelings. I mean, depending on how they're told, or heaven forbid if they find out from somebody other than you, then their feelings can be hurt. Which, you know, you could say, well, what the heck, you know, didn't trust their reaction. Maybe they should be aware that they're not particularly supportive people, you know, so I don't really care.
Right.
But were your parents' feelings hurt?
Well, my dad wouldn't have said so, even if
yeah.
it did hurt his feelings.
How would you know?
My mom, I don't think it hurt her feelings, but she would have been able to tell me. But I don't think it hurt her feelings at all. I just think that I think my folks wish that they could have been there with us and kind of held our hands through the process. I think they understood.
Do you think it matters from how a man deals with a diagnosis and whether it's male factor or female factor?
Absolutely.
In your case, it was both, but
yeah.
Yeah, but assuming not. Absolutely. Why?
Well, I'll tell you, I talk a little bit about this in the book, but there was a very clear moment when I thought, I can't recall if it was after the second failure or the third failure of the IVF, but my wife wanted children so badly. I thought maybe I'm just not the guy for her. And I know that I really hesitate to say that because I don't know if she even knows how much I thought about that, but I felt like very much less of a man because I couldn't give her this. And I felt like it was my fault.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she made it clear that, you know, no, this is both of our issues and we wouldn't, you know, that we're not going to go down that path at all. But that's what's going through my head, you know, and so I know that's going through other guys' heads that,
you're
like,
right.
Why can't I do this? This is my
You're
biological
exactly right.
function. You know, me, strong man, me make babies.
I'm not the person, if she wants this and I'm not the person, maybe I'm, as you say, I'm not the man for her. Maybe I shouldn't
exactly.
be. The person. Maybe I should step out of the way and let somebody else who can give her this. I don't think that's an unusual reaction at all.
It's not unusual, and it's it's sobering. It's a very it's sad, and it really pains me to know that there are so many other guys out there that are thinking that.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of it, that there's probably nobody that they can talk to about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because again, you're not going to go out with your buddies that you go to, you know, baseball games with and say, well, hey, you know, I'm thinking maybe I should let my wife go marry somebody else that can give her a child. It's just
mm-hmm.
not the kind of stuff that comes up. And so you bottle these things up. And at least for me, I kind of hit a breaking point.
In what way? What do you mean by that?
Well, I felt like I was going crazy. I mean, I don't even know if it was kind of a quasi depression. I kind of mm-hmm. fell into a real
it's
funk.
It's a depressing situation. Let's be honest. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a real haze where I could have probably seen a traffic accident happen right in front of me and not reacted. And that's very literally when I kind of shuffled upstairs to our attic where we had a desktop computer and started typing this thing out. Kind of this writing this book was it was supposed to be for other people, and it turned out it was also for me.
Yeah.
Because it was very cathartic.
Let me ask, did you consider at some point using donor sperm? Because obviously, you know, one option would be not to divorce, but to use donated sperm, and that would take your sperm issues out of the question. I mean, was that something that, at least in your head, did you start toying with it, or did that just seem too far removed for you to go there?
No, we did consider it. You know, we even got to the point where my wife was looking at all the profiles online and
mm-hmm.
trying to find somebody that was, you know, 6 feet tall, 180 pounds, blonde hair, trying to make a match. And you know, somebody had similar education, et cetera. And in conversation about that, because we both had issues, it felt like kind of an odd step to say that, well, this is going to work if we go this route.
That does seem, I can see your point. It'd be one thing if you were clearly the only one that, and she had, you know, her test results were perfect.
Yeah. We actually did what I think is called a DNA fragmentation test, where we had a semen analysis. It's funny, my sperm has been to North Dakota, but I haven't. We sent it to a lab in North Dakota.
You know what? You haven't missed much. Oh, wait, I've got to say that on national radio. Go ahead. Sorry, North Dakota, I was just teasing.
Yeah, there's a lab there, I guess, that does what's called a DNA fragmentation test, where they try to see if there's actually something wrong with the DNA, the helix of the makeup of the sperm. And if that would have come back suggesting that yeah, you know, not only is it kind of low motility and bad morphology, but your DNA is all messed up, then we probably would have charged forward with donor. But I can't say that for sure. But that came back just fine. Mm-hmm. And in fact, over time, the embryologist was saying that things were improving on my side. And so the kind of the donor just didn't seem logical for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Here's a question from Lynette that it's not directly on point for your experience, but we can still talk about it. She says, we've been diagnosed with unexplained infertility, which just drives my husband crazy. I think that this is maybe more of a male response than how a woman would handle it. I'd like to hear you and your guest discuss the infuriating diagnosis.
Yeah, your husband reacts exactly the same way that I would react, because I think the man's response is to fix things. So let me diagnose the problem, let me fix it. And I once said that any self-respecting doctor that said that there's unexplained infertility should just hang up his coat. That's not fair. But it just seems like it shouldn't be so complex to figure out what the problem is, because there you get kind of a 50-50 shot there, don't you? But
you know, it's not that case. I mean, you know, so often and I'm not trying to take up for the entire infertility medical community here, but if we think of conception as being so easy, and yet there are so many. I mean, it's almost a miracle we ever have babies anyway. If you look at all the things that could go wrong.
I totally agree. Yeah.
It's a freaking miracle we have babies.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and
I
that's
guess
why
I completely understand. But of course, I'm not the one living it, and I do understand. I honestly think, in fact, we've done a show on it, and we've got an upcoming show in the next late fall on unexplained infertility. I do think it is the hardest of all the diagnoses. I really believe.
Yeah, and I was actually being flippant there. I was just kind of that was always my reaction when I heard unexplained. It just didn't seem fair. You know, can't you just tell me what the problem is so we can address it and move on with our lives?
Now, I think your reaction is exactly the one most people feel like. It's just, oh, don't tell me it's unexplained, for goodness sakes.
Exactly. And you go through all these embarrassing moments where you've got to go do things you never thought you'd have to do. And your wife is getting poked and prodded and, you know, searched. And then they come back and tell you, well, we're not exactly sure what the problem is. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't seem fair. And I know, I totally agree with Lynette's husband that, it would make me crazy, and it just doesn't seem fair. So I think that's totally natural.
Well, you're speaking of all the embarrassing things. Well, I'm sitting here thinking the rest of the guys out there have their own stories to tell about the sperm analysis. But you may be unique in knowing that your mother-in-law is sitting in the next office while you're, as they so euphemistically say, producing a sample. I could only guess that was something you dreaded.
I don't even know if dread is the right word to describe it. It was one of the most bizarre experiences of my life. Yeah, so she's in the clinic, and I'm probably 10 feet away with the door closed. I don't think there's anything that can describe it. There's a chapter in the book that describes my first experience in there. In great detail, just because I felt like it was my obligation to share how embarrassing this was for me, so maybe another guy would think, okay, maybe my experience wasn't quite so bad. But the fact that I had to go in there, I believe it was 5 times that I had to go in there, and every single time there she'd be smiling at me. There's a really funny part at the towards the end of the book.
Can you tell it to us?
Well, it's a little PG-13, I'd say. But let's just say that my mother-in-law,
okay. Folks,
for our
if
last...
if you have children around, turn the computer away or don't let them listen. All right, go ahead, Michael.
Well, I'll give you I'll try to give it the PG version. For our last round, when she knew this was our last shot, we weren't going to do it again. She decided to go to a local, let's call it an adult store, and she handed me a big stack of inspirational materials for my last trip to the donation room. This is my mother-in-law, ladies and gentlemen, handing me a stack of just some of the most depraved material I've ever seen.
And I'm sure she told you she didn't look at any of it. She just picked up a handful and didn't select it with you specifically in mind, or at least I hope she said that.
I think she really quite enjoyed it, honestly. She had the biggest grin on her face, and she said she walked into that store and said, "I need some dirty magazines for my son-in-law." And they said, "You must be the greatest mother-in-law ever."
Well, all I can guess is that at some point, it helps to be able to approach this with humor. Now, not everybody would handle it, but she must have known that you were a safe person for her to play the humor card on, which probably speaks for your relationship, actually.
Oh, absolutely. She's a fantastic lady, and she's very funny, and we get each other's humor pretty well.
Yeah, and
actually,
that helps.
I was just going to say, in the book, I process a lot of stuff with humor, and maybe you can tell just from the way I am in this interview, but there's a lot of stuff in the book that I deal with humor, but I also try to, it's an incredibly honest book. I talk about how angry I am quite a bit, but I also deal with a lot of stuff via humor. I had one guy read the book, and he wrote to me, and he said it kind of felt like that you were my best friend, and we were just sitting there talking about your problems, and we were able to kind of share that story, and that's really, I just wanted it to be honest and tell the story from, a very authentic kind of point of view.
Well, I can only guess that would be the highest compliment, because in fact, as you point out, so many men don't have a best friend or a friend that they can go through this experience with. And in some ways, it's unfortunate. Well, in many ways, it's unfortunate. But I suspect that men might their friends might be more receptive, but it just would feel so alien and outside of the norm of what you normally talk about. That you mentioned anger, and I wanted to talk about that some, because I think that is also a common response to an infertility diagnosis. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always maybe look like anger, but I think so talk to us a little about the how anger played out in your responses.
Well, I tell you what, there was a lot of anger that boiled up in me, because I didn't understand what was going on, and I didn't understand why it was going on. But everybody around me in my workplace, everybody, and I'm sure anybody that's listening, knows this feeling. It seemed like everybody around me was having babies.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone in my workplace that was of an appropriate age, they were literally all getting pregnant, and there was so much celebration around it, and the baby showers, and people talking about names, and here I was making an appointment to go in and leave a sperm sample because mm-hmm. They were going to check my motility, and it drove me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I outwardly had to play the game and, say, "I'm so happy for you," and smile and buy, baby gifts. And it just really made me mad. Whether that was an appropriate response or not, I don't know, but that's just exactly the way I felt.
See, I don't think that it's fair to call in a response appropriate or inappropriate. If you punch the guy out, that's inappropriate. But, it seemed to me that the feelings are the feelings. I mean,
yeah.
I don't even buy that there's an appropriate or inappropriate feeling. There's an inappropriate way to perhaps express that feeling.
Yeah. No, I know. But, and there were a lot of ways, a lot of instances in our story, and some of them are in the book, where, I react in ways that are not very mature. And it's because I was just so mad and so frustrated about our situation. And a lot of that kind of goes back to the whole notion of being able to fix things. I just mm-hmm. couldn't fix it. There was nothing that I could do to help our situation. And it was just making me so mad. And everywhere we turned, it seemed like somebody had a big old belly, big baby bump, you know. And it's just like, well, of course you can get pregnant. Of course you can get pregnant. And we can't. And it just didn't seem fair. And I know a more mature way would be just to be a little bit more objective. But when you're in the thick of all this IVF business, it's really difficult to kind of stand back and be objective.
I think that some of the hardest parts of infertility is the fact that it can separate you from other people. And it does talk about it not infrequently, you know, the green eye of envy, you know, where it almost surprises people so often that they wouldn't have thought beforehand that they would have been capable of such a, as one woman said it, such a petty, mean response. And she said, I would have said that I wasn't that person.
Exactly.
And, but she said, in fact, you know, I am that person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did it affect your relationship? Because sometimes the anger comes out towards the spouse, even if that person is not the one who, you know, perhaps that person is the first one. So it's not a logical person, not a logical target necessarily, but it often can affect the relationship. So did it affect yours?
Yeah, it definitely did. But I'm trying to figure out the right way to say this. I'm surprised it didn't affect it more. We're both pretty passionate people, but I don't think that we really had thought about the way that we communicate very well until we went through this. In fact, until we got out of this, rather, because I tend to bottle things up. I don't express myself very well when I'm dealing with complicated matters of our marriage. And it's a character flaw, I'll admit it. And she's very expressive and she wants to talk about things. And typically I don't. And this is something that you need to talk about. And so that created a lot of stress. And I'm surprised we didn't have more difficulty. but there were times when we were definitely on separate pages. And it took a lot of work on my part to be able to kind of understand how I needed to communicate with her. And it took a lot of patience on her part to figure out how to deal with the way that I process things. And we managed to find common ground, but I've always wondered, I mean, it seems like, I'm sure this study has been done, but the divorce rates for folks that have gone through IVF and such, because it's an incredibly, incredibly stressful thing on a relationship.
You know, it's funny when I have talked with experts, scientists who are doing the research, psychologists and who are doing the research, a lot of them say that, in fact, they have not seen that. But I am with you. That surprises me because I just across the board, it seems like stress is oftentimes detrimental to marriages. And it's hard to imagine. There are more stressful things, I am sure. But there have been studies which indicate that infertility ranks right on up there with some of the biggest stresses, death of a spouse, cancer diagnosis, things like that. Infertility ranks right in there with them. So I'm kind of amazed as well. Some people say that at the end they have come out strong, the marriage came out stronger, while others will say that the marriage came out weakened, but that they're working to put it back together. And when I say came out, in your case, it would be a successful result. For other people, it is yours is through conception. For other people, it may be through adoption. For others, it may be through making the decision that they're going to live child-free. But regardless of what the outcome is, I hear it both ways, where some people say the marriage is stronger and others say it's not on life support, but we're having to work through to repair it. What would be from the other people, from the reception, both your experience as well as the reception from the book, do you have any feel for what's more common?
Well, that's a good question. In our case, we're absolutely stronger. And I think a lot of it can be pointed to when we deal with something stressful, we think, well, that's not as bad as this that we went through. For instance, our 2-year-old broke his femur this summer and was placed in basically a body cast. And if you can imagine a body cast on a 2-year-old that can't talk and you know, you have to try to keep him clean, that that wasn't very fun at all. And yet, you know, we were just happy he was there, you know, so you just kind of deal with the situation. But yeah, we've easily come out on the positive side, but I think we're the lucky ones. The folks that I've talked to, it seems like it's kind of a coin toss, but I think a lot of it has to do with the outcome. Because there's, you know, folks that have to move on and say that we're going to live childless, I think that would be a pretty stressful situation. And the folks that I've talked to that are in that boat, there's only a few that are really strong enough to say that, hey, maybe this is for the best. You know, we can go travel the world and not have the same kind of obligations that we would have with kids. And I give them a lot of credit for that. Other folks, I think, have a lot of anger related to it.
The other thing that we often hear that is so fundamentally changed in a way that is, I think, hard for both the male and the female, is your sex life, is your intimate relationship. There is nothing more destroying to intimacy than infertility in so many ways. Can you talk to us some about that, about how it does affect your intimate life?
Well, when we were going through the IVF process, it definitely affected it. It's kind of difficult to just put all the stress of your situation out of your mind and you know, allow yourself to be.
When you're having it timed down to the hour, it doesn't lend itself to, it sure as heck is not candles and moonlight, let's be honest.
Exactly. But I we've had no ill effects afterwards.
And I think a lot of people can get, but if one of your ways of feeling close to your spouse is through your sex life, and that it's like a double whammy when you're going through infertility, because that has been taken away, and that may be one thing that drew you closer. And now, you know, you're not only are you in the middle of stress, but no longer is that a source of comfort. Which is why a lot of psychologists recommend, you know, don't try every month. Take a month off every once in a while, where you can just be okay. Whenever we feel like it, we can. If we don't feel like it, we won't. We don't have to. We just want to reconnect as a couple, not with the agenda of we're trying to get pregnant.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things that a lot of guys worry about ahead of time is it's often, in fact, probably most often, the husband that is the one who is the shot giver during the IVF cycle. And I think that's a huge source of anxiety for a lot of guys. Was it for you?
I hate needles. I mean,
oh dear.
I'm getting just kind of clammy thinking about it. If I have to give blood, or when I have to have a shot of any kind, it's about 50-50 that I have to lay down. I get really dizzy, and I'm just that guy for some reason. So I'll tell you, I was anxious, but my wife was really anxious.
Yeah, because you come at me with a needle. I got
exactly.
News for you. You would not inspire confidence.
Exactly. And I'll tell you a funny story from when we sat down with the nurse that was kind of giving us the instructions about how to give the shots and do the mixture of all the concoctions that you have to use. She wanted me to practice, and there was this, it was kind of like a dome, if you will. It was kind of like a fake buttocks that I was supposed to practice putting this needle into. And she was kind of showing me the jabbing motion that I was supposed to use. And, I grabbed it with confidence, and I stabbed that thing down and I bent that needle in at a right angle. And my wife said, "That's it. You're not giving me shots." And so she actually went into the clinic and had the nurse give the shots for that first round while I practiced on an orange. And I'll tell you what,
so she practiced in front of her, no doubt.
Exactly. I had that orange so full of hormones that I probably could have gotten the orange pregnant. But
that medicine was way too expensive for that. You were using
No, you're absolutely right. But actually, it got to be something that I don't know. It was weird. We almost embraced that time. It was. I remember it was 10 o'clock every night. We would do the shots, and it was 10 o'clock because we picked it kind of strategically, because it was usually if we wanted to go out to dinner with friends, you know, there was still plenty of time to get home and do the shot at night. And I kind of took great pride in mixing it and, you know, getting the bubble out and, you know, finding the space and icing it and you know, doing it with as little pain as possible and then doing all the things I was supposed to do right. And so it was kind of – it was my routine, and I took pride in it, and I actually really embraced it, and I didn't have a problem with it, you know, for the remainder of that time. And there were no bent needles.
We won't ask about bruises. Bent needles.
Yeah, there were those.
Yeah, I bet there were. Well, that's actually a healthy way to, and it seems to me, to approach it, because what you're saying is basically that you owned it. As you know, one of the frustrating things about infertility is that there's not a darn thing that often you can do that will, I mean, there's just nothing you can really do. I mean, yes, you can get your sperm analysis done. You can do this. But there's not, at least with the giving of the shots, it's something that you as a man can do that's specifically taking you the next step towards your goal. And women
right.
have a lot more of those opportunities, I think, than men do in this, the whole infertility business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something that you can control. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. You could try. You can learn something. You can master it. You can do. Yeah. So that's probably.
I'll tell you what, I told my mother-in-law, I was like, well, if anybody ever needs, we had some friends that also went through this, and I kind of thought, you know, I wouldn't mind giving the shots if I have to. I'm pretty good at it.
And the woman and the other couple said, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks a lot, but no. Another thing that I hear from men and from women talking about their men is the what I'm going to put under the general rubric of handling your wife's pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily mean, but although I would like to talk about the physical pain as well, because there are definitely aspects of infertility treatment that are physically painful, including receiving shots. But I also, perhaps more speaking of the emotional pain, and I particularly hear from women who will say that the hardest part of it makes it hard for women too, but they think that the hardest part for their husbands is that they are in pain and their husbands don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about how that played out in your situation?
Well, that's one of the most valuable lessons that I probably learned from this, was that there was a point at which my wife just said, I don't want you to fix the situation because you can't. What I need you to do is tell me that you understand that, yeah, this sucks. I want you to hug me and tell me that you're sorry and that you understand. And that's really what she needed from me. And so here I am trying to fix the situation. And when she'd curl up into a little ball and start weeping, I would just kind of run my, you know, put my hands up on my head and think, how, what am I supposed to do about this? I haven't been trained in how to do this. You know, none of this was modeled for me. And what she needed was for me to say, I understand. I understand this is impossible, and I'm sorry, and we're going to get through it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a really valuable thing in our marriage, because now I get it. She doesn't need me to fix things
mm-hmm.
when I can't. A lot of times, you know, something will come up at work or something will come up with a friend. And now I know. I know what she needs. And so it was very simple, but it took us a long time to get to that point. But that was really rather kind of a breakthrough for us.
I think it would be, and I'm hoping that, I imagine we will have a lot of guys listening to this show, and I can't help but think that's probably the most valuable thing they're going to hear is that sometimes we don't want you to fix it. You can't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't kid yourself. You're not going to fix it. You know, if it could be fixed, we'd have figured out how to fix it ourselves. But we just need not to be alone with it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Did you seek out counseling?
Let me think about that.
It is something we often recommend. If you don't want to talk about it, that is fine. It is something
we often
recommend.
We didn't. No, but we probably should have. Because perhaps somebody could have suggested that last tip to me a lot earlier. But no, we didn't.
I would highly recommend it. Yeah, I would as well. And one of the things that I love to see is when infertility clinics will have either a therapist on staff or a therapist they work closely with. And it doesn't have to be on staff, but somebody who gets infertility, who you know, a therapist. I mean, there's not like a separate training that they go through on how to help women with couples. I shouldn't say women, men and women. With fertility issues, but it helps. But a therapist who has had a lot of experience with it, it is useful to seek one out. And I'd love to see fertility clinics that have that. And so often it's not the doctor, but it's the nurse who is the one who suggests, have you thought about seeking out? You know, we work with a great therapist. You know, schedule an appointment or two, and you know. Just for support, if nothing else.
Yeah, no, it frankly should be a mandatory part of the process. I mean, even before you start going, when you make the decision to go and do some of the assisted reproductive technology, I think talking with a therapist before you go into it and while you're going through it would be really valuable.
Yeah, but you know, people, we say that, and I'm going to say, oh yeah, you're exactly right, and yet. I don't, it's like the stigma associated with counseling has been a slow one to die. It's like people will give lip service to it. Oh,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, yeah, of course. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, no, I think anybody should do it. But when, and I don't know if this is more male than female, and this may not be, and it may be one, I may be making a gender stereotype that's inaccurate here, but it does feel like that women might be more receptive to going to see a counselor. Than a guy. Am I on left field, do you think?
That was very delicately put, but I mean, I would absolutely say, I mean, it would be the last thing that I would want to do.
Yeah.
I mean, even I would probably rather have gone and done what I had to do, you know, down the hallway from my mother-in-law than go and talk to a therapist. But I guess looking back, and I know, you know, hindsight is 20/20, but if I can provide any kind of advice at all, it would have been tremendous help. And just to have somebody say, look, you know, you two are going to go through a real roller coaster here, and you need to figure out how to talk to each other about the stresses that you're going to go through, just to prepare you for that, so that. Because I think we both got into it and thought, well, we're just going to do this crazy thing where they're going to make a baby in a test tube and we're going to have a baby and that's going to be great. We had no idea that it was going to be such a roller coaster ride, and it was going to take so long, and it was going to be so painful and stressful. And I think to have somebody at least prepare you for that kind of journey and say, look, you got to prepare yourselves and prepare your marriage for something that could get pretty hairy. I just think that would be really, really helpful. And if it's just a 15-minute consultation before you go through your first round or something like that, I think it would just be helpful to know, okay, let's just try to be objective and try to, you know, kind of go in feet first here.
True. And yet, yeah, you're exactly right. I think that would be the number one. It would add money to the process, although you know,
yeah.
In fact, perhaps it doesn't, wouldn't need to, in the sense that it could be something that would be provided, just an initial, and perhaps if it's done at the very beginning, it might make couples more likely to seek it out when the going does get rough, you know, because they already have something of a relationship established back in the early days when they're sure it's not going to be them.
Right.
They're sure everybody goes into it for the most part, if not with assurance, but at least with the secret hope that they're going to be the ones who get pregnant on the first either IUI or the first IVF or whatever.
Right. Well, you know, our biggest concern was that we were going to get triplets. That's how naive we were. Because we
Something to be very worried about. Let me tell you.
Well,
that
sure.
Let me tell you, that's a huge worry of mine. But nonetheless, I hear what you're saying. That, you never. The thought of failure wasn't it. The thought of over success was. You know.
That's right.
Yeah, was where you at? Well, when you did find out that you were pregnant without having tried, I imagine from what you're saying, you were in the waiting list for a child from China.
Right.
Probably right about the time when the waits were increasing dramatically.
Right.
I'm guessing, yeah. So when you were when you found out you were pregnant, one of the things that people tell us is that it's hard to relax into the pregnancy. It's hard to even the pregnancy. Did you experience that as well?
I was a basket case. I was an absolute basket case because we very much felt like this was kind of our miracle kid, and we couldn't let anything happen to him because we just weren't going to be able to do it again because the IVF didn't work, you know, four times, and we weren't going to go back to that. And I was a complete wreck. And on the day that he was born, I had to talk myself out of an absolute panic attack while I was waiting outside the room to go in. I was so nervous. And it wasn't nervous about being a father and about seeing him. It was so nervous that something was going to go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That was a really crazy time. It kind of, I get a little choked up thinking about it, because it was just, it was obviously fabulous. It was wonderful, but I was scared to death.
How long did that fear last? The fear that something could happen to him. How long did that last after his birth? Or has it ever gone away? How old was he before, you said?
No, you know, I worry about him, but I think I worry about him like any other parent would. He came out and he was born a little bit early, and he wasn't breathing on his own. He was pretty blue when he came out, and there was a moment when I thought he wasn't going to make it, and I thought, this is it. But then he decided to start breathing. It's actually exactly the way that I was born. So it's something unfortunate that I passed on, but he spent a little time in the ICU. And once he was out of there, and it was really almost instantaneous that we just kind of, I mean, I still worry about him, but you know, once he was in his mom's arms, and he just, it was just very natural, and that anxiety wore off pretty quickly.
And so you don't find that you don't feel like you're an overprotective parent, as because we also hear from parents who have arrived at parenthood after a long journey, either through successful treatment, donor egg or donor sperm or IVF or through adoption, that they tend to be, they feel like they might be, and I think there's actually some evidence to support this, overprotective of their children. And I don't know if you experience that. Of course, you've now had three in total, so that may help you relax a little more. If because you don't have time to be overprotected.
I was just going to say, I don't have time to be overprotected. No, I don't think so. Even when he was the only one, I don't think that we were overprotective with him. I mean, I don't think we're any different. Just kind of observing our other friends with children. I don't think that we really are overprotective in comparison to them.
Mm-hmm. By the way, we just got an email from Russell saying, love the show, can't wait to read the book, Us Guys Are Often So Alone.
Thank you, Russell. And I wrote it for you.
One back at you, Russell. Oh, and I think we have time to talk about one last question, and that is, were you always in agreement on how many the steps up the infertility treatment ladder and when to step off of that ladder? That's a hard thing for couples to navigate. And I wonder if men and women navigate those decisions about, do we take this next, what seems to be, and certainly the infertility clinics was presented as the next logical step. Do you think that there is a difference in how men and women make those decisions?
I'm sure there is a difference.
Was there in your case? Did you have a difference?
Well, what I can say is, I mean, we did the IVF and then we did the ICSI, and that was just the recommendation of the lab. And I think both of us didn't really have any qualms about that at all. But it was the number of rounds, and I also describe this in the book. There's a point at which we were not seeing eye to eye, and a lot of it was the decision to do the fourth round. Because my wife was in a place where she thought this just doesn't work. I'm not putting my body through this again. Absolutely not. And I felt like I knew her well enough to know that she was not feeling like we were finished. And that's kind of a delicate thing for me to, you know, think that I can crawl into her head and say, no, I know actually what you're thinking. So we went at it a little bit on that one. And then finally, it was when we basically agreed that, okay, yeah, the fourth round is it, and we're done, and we're just going to move on with adoption. Actually, what we did was we applied to adopt while we did the fourth round. So it was kind of a ringer. We knew there was going to be a baby at the end of this, one way or the other, whether we had to fly to get it or not. You know, and that was kind of the process we went through. But, yeah, definitely there was a lot of a lot of kind of miscommunication between the two of us about how many rounds to do. But that was the only point that we had gone through that. There really wasn't much in the way of, you know, we didn't argue about how many eggs to put in or what kind of process to go through or anything like that.
Okay, and that's good, because certainly how many eggs to put in is a big one, but often infuriatingly not discussed as much as I would like to see it discussed.
Yeah, it always seemed like it was kind of the decision of the lab. Based on the quality, and that was a very strange thing for them to say, well, you know, one looks fantastic and one looks pretty good, and this last one we're not so sure about, but we're going to toss it in there anyway. And it was just a very strange thing that, you know, we didn't really feel like we had much authority over that decision making, because, you know, I couldn't look at the embryo and go, actually, I disagree with you. I don't think this one looks right, or something like that, because I don't have that expertise. But so there was a lot of trust there.
Well, and there has to be a lot, you know, a lot of trust. And in fairness, I would agree with that there really does have to be trust. But I also think there has to be the couple needs to be a part of the decision, because they're the ones, and we hear from them, who then are faced with decisions when all of a sudden they have three.
Right.
Or they're the ones who are parenting twins when they really don't want to be, although quite frankly most people who have been infertile don't mind that, you know, being in that position. Well, we have reached the end of our time. Thank you so much, Michael Barr, for being our guest today on Creating Family. Thanks for joining us today, and I will see you next week.